Support for the Commodity Week podcast comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign with crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is the Friday, January the 21st edition of Commodity Week. Welcome to Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason. During this half hour, we'll explore how many acres of corn will need to be planted to make the balance sheets work next year and how high the price of new crop corn might need to go to put those acres in the ground.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Our panelists on this edition of Commodity Week include Pete Manhart of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, Jackie Bakes from Stuart Peterson in Champaign, Illinois, Mike Zuzolo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting from Lafayette, Indiana, and our guest to talk about CFTC's proposed rules on commodity trade, University of Illinois ag economist Scott Herwin.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Well, let's start with this question. Jackie Vakes and Forma on Friday came out with their estimates for the coming crop year planted acres. They now put corn at 90.9 million and soybeans at 76.65. For reference sakes, USDA's last year crop, that's the one we just harvested, at 88.2 million and 77.4. So corn up a couple of million. And the beans were, well, down just slightly. What'd you make of those numbers?
Well, I think if you look at the overall, the expectation was that we were going to see higher numbers on the corn acres, higher than 90.9. And you could see it in the market. You know, the market took a bounce as soon as the numbers came out. I really think 92 million is probably closer to what we really need. The question comes down to where we're going to get it from. And everybody expected to see bean acres drop. I think that the one thing we have to take into account, and I'm sure Informa's looking at it, is we're probably going to pick up maybe 3.5 to 4 million bean acres, basically on double crop, if we have decent, you know, a decent opportunity with the weather. So what do I make out of it? Well, 100,000 acres is not a lot of a move. So maybe it reinforces what we've been saying. Farmers are not that anxious to change their acres over.
Pete?
Yeah, you had USDA's planted from last year, but Informa's number last time was 90.8, so they only went up 100,000. And they went down only 900,000 on the beans. In central Illinois and central Iowa and a lot of the Midwest, it's already planned. The fertilizer's on, the nitrogen's on, unless they were too dry. So I don't see much change from these. We really need, as Jackie said, more acres. But if you look at available acres, I don't think we can get more than 4 or 5 million acres into those three crops without – I don't think we can get more than those acres because we've got everything else in competition also.
And Mike Zuzolo.
Todd, if you use that 91 million, there's just no cushion, like Jackie said. And if you use a 13.5 or a 13.6 demand, you just can't build the carryover this coming year using Informa's Friday number. And especially if you don't use their yield number, they came in at a very lofty yield number of 163.8. We probably can do that if we have really ideal conditions, but if we're putting in more marginal land, I think that's going to be a little bit harder. I think the other thing that maybe needs to be looked at, too, is when you look at all the principal crops, there were 2 years, 2000 and 2008, when we were able to take up the crops, all eight of the big crops, take them up above 253 million acres, up towards 254 and a half million. There might be a little extra crop acreage numbers out there if these prices stay as high as they are right now or even go higher. as we get into February. It seems to me from traveling around that producers are very itchy to get in the ground this year, and if Mother Nature cooperates and the February base price for crop insurance cooperates, we may be able to hit those 2000 and 2008 crop levels in terms of acreage planted, and that would give you a little bit more supply cushion then.
In fact, Darrell Good this week in his weekly outlook wrote just a bit about those numbers, and by comparison, planted acres last year were down 8.3 million from 2008. Yeah. And Darrell says there's been a decline, or CRP, acres that are coming out, at 3.4 million. That's what, 11.7. 3.7 went into wheat. That leaves about 6 million acres for the spring planted crop. So the question is, how high does new crop corn have to go to gather what you think might be a number, and we'll start with you, Mike, that would allow the next year's carryout to be, well, acceptable?
I think we're there right now. Is it can we hold it? And I think that's where the wheat really comes back into play. And I think that's why I'll say it again, and I know I'm getting to be a broken record, but I really think wheat is the leader. And I think the Southern Plains, especially with the new National Weather Service long-term outlook and what my own consultant's telling me, is that we're probably going to get drier and colder as we get into February as far as the middle part of the country. So I think wheat acreage being ripped up is very, very likely. A good client in Texas told me this week that he went to his farm credit, looked over everything, and for the first time in his career, he's able to plant anything and make money in terms of sorghum, cotton, beans, corn. So he is looking at ripping up acres. And so I think if you rip up acres, it's probably going to go towards the corn side. And here again, it probably means a more marginal yield, but you can do a lot if Mother Nature cooperates this spring.
So your suggestion is that December corn at 587 and a quarter, which is where we settled today, is enough. Is that right?
If we don't slip from here and the bean-corn ratio stays where it's at, I think we are there at this point.
And soybeans finished at the November at 1348 and a quarter. They were up 25 for the week. Do you think he's right? Is that number enough, or do you have to take new crop corn up higher?
I don't think it's enough. If I'm on a normal rotation in the great Midwest straits that produce the biggest majority of our corn and bean crop, dry land acres aren't going to matter that much as far as total crop. I don't think you're going to get farmers in central Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, eastern Nebraska, eastern Kansas, Indiana, Ohio to change much unless we have a lot higher prices. And in those areas, unless they were super dry, they've already got the stuff in the ground. I don't see them changing unless we get exorbitant prices either on beans or on corn. If I've got $14 beans, why do I want to switch to $5.50 corn?
And I agree with you. I don't think we're high enough. And I don't think we're high enough for a different reason. In the guys that I've been talking to in all the states that Pete was just talking about, we're seeing guys going away from corn on corn and going to beans. And so, you know, the mix of corn on corn is certainly a part of Informa's numbers. I think that we definitely have to have a higher price. I wouldn't be surprised. You know, from a technical standpoint, I think the futures will try and find its way back up to the old December 11 high, which was 660.
Mike, I don't usually do this, but I'm going to let you defend your position on this one again. Why do you think we're okay at this point?
Well, I think it's because we build in enough premium at this point from a global standpoint, Todd. I mean, when you look at the global wheat ending stocks, we're dealing with 50 million tons more than we had back in the low point in 07. With the beans, oil seeds were a good 10 million tons over in global ending stocks. And in the coarse grains, we've built a supply cushion as well. When you look at just plain ending stocks, now, I grant you, when you look at stocks-to-use ratios, we are too tight, but you're using stocks-to-use ratios and demand levels that suggest that we're going to keep building demand. And I think we're at price levels here based upon the interest rates, based upon the emerging markets fighting inflationary pressures and getting serious about it like Brazil did this week. I think you're going to see some demand pullback, and that's normal when you get into these kind of price level years.
What price level do we need to cut back demand, and what are they going to use instead of our products to fill that hole that they need for their demand? Everything is priced high, switching from one to the other. Yeah, we can go to feed wheat. That'll help some. But we still need, if we're going to double the hog population in China, how much more corn and soybean meal do we need?
Well, that's true. And, you know, when you take, and you mentioned ending stocks, Mike, when you take ending stocks and convert it into days of supply, we're down to about 20 days of supply on corn and 15 days of supply on beans here in the U.S. And I think that, you know, we have to really be aggressive and try and get people to plant this. So I think it's going to take more than that. Even at the world level, 53 days of corn and 83 days of beans, and most of those beans are in South America.
All right. We'll agree to disagree on that one. I'll let
That's
it go.
Great.
But I do want one other thing from both you, Jackie, and you, Pete. What price would cause producers to plant more corn?
I think that we have to get, if we can get up and get a futures price back up near the 650 level, I think that we've got a chance.
I think the corn ratio has to go different against the bean ratio to plant more corn, especially with the experience a lot of the Midwest had on second, third, fourth year corn last year. I think we have to have that ratio of corn be better than it is now.
Here the way the numbers settled up in Chicago on the weekly trade, the high price in the corn for the week was $6.67. The low at 627.5. Settlement price there was 8.5 cents higher than the week prior at $6.57 1/4 in the March, December, up 16 on the week at $5.87 1/4. The soy complex finished the March contract at $14.12 1/4. It was down 10 1/4, with a high on the week at $14.31 3/4, a low at $13.83 1/2. Once again, $14.12 1/4, the settlement price off 10 1/4 in the March beans, the new crop November, at $13.48 1/4, up 25 cents, and will capture the wheat at this point, too. March contract at $8.30 for the high, the low at $7.73 1/2. It gained, and it was the biggest gainer on the week by far, up 51 1/4 cents at $8.24 1/2 in the March. July at $8.66 3/4 cents. It was up 39. Mike, I'll let you talk about wheat because you like it when it leads.
I do, and it's because it goes back to that feed side. And then Pete brought this up too, Todd. When you go to a low enough level in terms of wheat price to corn price, the wheat starts to eat into the corn demand. And we actually heard rumors of that this week in terms of China looking at buying maybe Australian feed wheat to feed their livestock for. And I think that kicked off the midweek turnaround in wheat, and it brought the spread back around. And then you had a big contingency of Middle Eastern buyers. Turkey came in, number one buyer on our weekly sales report. Jordan, Tunisia, Algeria, all in for wheat. Probably see some more come in next week. And I think that's where the best-looking ending stocks number for me, excuse me, for 2011 is wheat. We're running at about 30% above year-to-date levels in terms of export, accumulated exports right now in the wheat, whereas in the corn and the wheat, we're not doing much better than last year. Corn and beans, we're not doing much better than last year. So I like that wheat to continue to lead. And it does promote more upside of corn. If the wheat continues to go up, the corn, I think, will follow.
Do you think soybeans are high enough priced at this point, Pete?
I don't think anything's high enough priced because of the day supply that we have of product to feed the world.
Yeah, but I'm wondering, if you think corn has to go higher compared to soybeans, doesn't that, I mean,
they're going to drag each other up.
Does corn, how much will it, I mean, soybeans have to set back in your mind, I assume.
I think everything will set back just like it did in 08. In 08, we went down 60, 70, and 50 in January, April, and May on the way to new highs. I think we'll still have that. But I think we'll make all-time new highs this year in corn, beans, and maybe wheat.
All-time new highs, you think?
In corn and beans.
All right. And so my suggestion was that while soybeans might drag higher, but they would lag behind the corn. Is that what you're thinking?
They would lag behind the corn.
Well,
what are you saying to me?
If you're suggesting that corn needs to have a higher price in order to put enough acres in the ground, then that ratio between the corn and the soybeans has to widen, does it not?
Well, if you take a step back into history and you look when we hit 660 on corn in December 11, we hit 1550 on beans. You know, so the ratio really wasn't a whole lot different in that respect. So I think they just, you know, they move in unison with each other. And when you get to that point, the fight gets serious.
What I'm saying is I think the ratio is going to stay the same so that we aren't going to get those more corn acres. And I think they're going to help drag each other up. And wheat, with the bad wheat crop we have in the northern hemisphere, is going to also help drag everything higher. And as a result, we have less days of food for the world.
Mike?
Well, I think your point is well taken when it comes to South America, Todd. I think one of the things that bothers me about the nearby beans, if I were a producer right now and I were sitting with extremely overbought conditions on the daily, weekly, and monthly charts, and I was wondering if I shouldn't diversify some of my risk, it would be in the old crop beans right now, I think, especially if we come back next week and don't turn the thing around led by wheat and corn. But South American weather market, that rally is probably ending because of the improved weather in Argentina especially. And I think you've also got to realize there is some harvest coming. Maybe it'll be a down harvest for corn when it comes to Argentina, but I think that Brazil is looking at a near record, maybe even a record crop right now, unless rust breaks out. So I think here again, the bear spread's going to be probably key in the beans all the way through to the March report by USDA. But I think your point may be well taken when it comes to the South American weather rally being maybe at the end. Beans didn't get hurt as bad on Argentine weather. Corn did.
You're listening to Commodity Week. This is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can always hear it online at willag.org. That's willag.org. More when we come back in just 2 minutes. We'll talk with University of Illinois ag economist Scott Irwin.
I'm Steve Hilberg with the Midwestern Regional Climate Center located at the Illinois State Water Survey in Champaign. Chalk up another cold and snowy week for the state of Illinois. Temperatures this week were near to below normal across the entire state, with the greatest departures from normal in western Illinois. There, temperatures averaged 4 degrees below normal. We did enjoy a relatively mild day on Monday when temperatures reached the low 30s in northern Illinois and the mid-40s in southern Illinois. Another cold front sweeping through the state late on Tuesday brought an end to that. Much colder air then followed the storm on Thursday. Snow fell at one time or another on most of Illinois this week. Several inches of snow occurred across northern Illinois on Monday, with some light snow and freezing rain, drizzle, and sleet thrown in for good measure further south. The more significant snow occurred beginning late Wednesday night into Thursday. 5 to 9 inches of snow accumulated in a band along Interstate 70, with the heaviest amounts in the metro east area of St. Louis. Little of the snow reached northern Illinois, save for a few flurries on Thursday morning. We will be singing the same cold and snowy tune next week as well. Snow is possible across Illinois on Monday as another disturbance passes through the Midwest. Temperatures will gradually moderate through midweek, but it will remain colder than normal. By next weekend, some more light snow and a reinforcing surge of cold air is possible. For the Midwestern Regional Climate Center in Champaign, I'm Steve Hilberg.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is the January 21st edition of Commodity Week. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Our panelists in studio include Pete Manhart of Bates Commodities, Jackie Bakes of Stuart Peterson, and Mike Zuzalo is on the phone line. Our guest is actually in studio today as well, ag economist from the University of Illinois, Scott Irwin. He's here to explain what the CFTC has proposed in the last week about commodity marketing trading and his viewpoint on that proposal. Why don't you go through the proposal very quickly for me, please?
All right. It's a sweeping change in the oversight of our commodity markets as proposed, and it's also part of a very large set of proposed rules in general for derivatives and options and futures markets. The basic rule that is getting the most attention is putting new speculative position limits in place that would be applied to all kinds of commodity futures markets, not just our traditional ag markets. And the exact level that those position limits would be set could be potentially variable in the rules. But the real key is that it will aggregate the positions for a particular firm in the swap market and the commodity futures markets together. This is the idea of trying to eliminate a supposed loophole where someone can evade the speculative position limits by, in essence, trading in the cash over the counter market.
So does it actually, when it aggregates, does it make this position limit smaller in total or not?
Effectively, it does, because the firms that these are targeted towards have massive positions in this over-the-counter market. So when you put them together with the futures, it's likely to bind on some of the really big players.
Do we have any historical perspective as to what happens when CFTC does something like this?
You'd really have to go back to the 1930s when the position limits were first imposed. And I honestly can't remember what happened then.
Well, you're not that old.
Come on now. I'm not that old either, but I do remember what happened then when they put the limits in on crude oil and the majority of the market went over to London and they left this area, you know. So I think they have to be careful. You know, it's this definitely concerns me from a Democratic standpoint in terms of our freedoms. What's your opinion, Scott, and when you look at the index funds, do you see them just as speculators or do you see them potentially as hedging their portfolios over in the stock market? In other words, being actual hedgers in this market?
I think the majority of the index fund positions are, in fact, hedging in that context of someone trying to hedge or diversify some kind of financial portfolio risk. There's also some evidence that some of them are just making large long-term plays in the commodity markets. So it's probably a mixture, but I do agree that by far and away the dominant motivation is to diversify and hedge.
I don't know what to ask except that in the news lately, some large bank in England owns 60% of the silver in the world. If we're going to have limits on paper, will there ever be limits on things like that? And the bank has said, well, we do this for all kinds of people. Will they aggregate all that together in the commodity market?
No, that's, I think, an excellent point and an example of what could be some of the unintended consequences of this. If it's put in place, it's proposed, if it is in fact voted in and put in place, and the limits are finally in the final rule set tight enough that those kind of big market participants are limited in the size of their positions. If they want to own commodities, they're going to own commodities. They'll just go to the cash market. And we've already seen that. That's one example. And I don't think that that's really the kind of direction that we want to send those kind of market participants.
I can remember back years ago when the Hunt brothers had silver. They got fined and fined and fined, and they had to get out of those. And now some bank owns, 60 or 70% of the silver in the world. I guess I don't understand the FTC versus that or how they're going to aggregate it.
Well, the CFTC chairman has made it clear that actual traditional cash market positions will not be counted in any of this. This is only the futures positions and then the positions that are called swap transactions or over-the-counter contracts.
I'll let Mike Zuzulo ask a question in a moment. Is this a good idea or a bad idea in your opinion?
I think it's a bad idea. The best way I can describe it, the entire effort is a solution looking for a problem.
Mike?
I love the report, especially the job of illustrating that you did the extremes on this issue. And when I read about the German researcher just March of last year saying speculation not only amplified the prices, it's killed thousands of people. I thought that was a wonderful way to illuminate how this has come about and that it's very politically driven and we've gotten to an extreme. I'm wondering, when I looked at an OPEC report this week, and I think Todd forwarded it to you, when I looked at their classification of why they didn't raise the production levels was because of money managers, the different category, the non-swaps dealers that the CFTC looks at. I wonder, are we focusing our attention on the wrong group? Because they did make a pretty compelling argument with the way the crude oil price traces with the long net long position of money managers. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that, if you'd looked down that path at all.
I haven't looked at that data specifically, but I did have a chance to skim that report. I think we have to remember that, gosh, anything coming out of OPEC might just have a market perspective on it. And so I wouldn't want to take their market analysis at face value, because they clearly have the probably the world's largest market interest in any market.
Not even the chart, Dr. Scott?
No, I mean, I saw that because we have to be so careful when we see those kind of charts, because we don't know if the correlation really, when you drill down and look at it real carefully on a daily or within day basis, you know, are those positions leading price movements? Are they trailing or neither? And those, I think, can be used to create impressions when you dig down into the details don't really pan out.
I see.
Do you think, Scott, that this is a lot of to-do about nothing and more of a response to Congress just pushing and trying to force them to take action, and yet this is a reactive move being mm-hmm. supported by very little? Ultimately, do you think they're going to really do this?
Tough call. I think that the Commissioner Dunn made very interesting comments after the hearing was over, where they released the rules, indicating that he was not a sure vote for these rules. And so if he votes against it, we already know pretty much that the two that are on the Republican side are going to vote against it. It's at least possible that this may not actually ever get out of the CFTC. Some are, though, arguing that the new Dodd-Frank law locks the CFTC into having to do it. So mm-hmm. this is going to take a while to be played out.
Do they question anything to the effect that when somebody buys corn at $6.50, somebody else has to sell it to them? And which one of those guys is the speculator that's causing all this trouble?
Yeah, exactly. You know, my mentor and longtime friend Tom Hieronymus put it this way, you know, market opinion is always balanced at the market price. And so somebody has got an opinion that price is going up. Somebody's got an opinion price is going to go down. And that's a fundamental reality of these markets. It doesn't mean that these kind of large-scale financial flows don't have any impacts, at least conceptually. But my bottom line is I've dug and dug and dug and dug and dug in the data, and I can't find the smoking gun.
I think it gives people an opportunity to get in and do things. It gives more opportunity in the market.
Well, and I think there was an article in Bloomberg that pretty much spoke volumes on this. They said if the CFTC doesn't make up its mind by the end of January, the ruling might not come until 2012.
There we go.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Irwin. We do appreciate you taking the time and coming over from Mumford Hall with us. Scott Irwin is a University of Illinois ag economist. Now for a final word from our panelists, we'll start with you, Mike Zuzulo.
Well, the weekly fundamentals continue to promote the idea that we're on track for an 08 and 81 type early March, maybe late February high. So keep that pencil sharp.
Pete Manhart?
Be ready to sell or protect prices. We have all kinds of opportunities here to make money at all kinds of different prices.
And Jackie Bakes.
Certainly be prepared to sell old crop. We're starting to hear across the nation that there are elevators that are no longer writing any contracts. They're only accepting nearby corn.
That is this edition of Commodity Week for the 21st day of January. You can always hear it again if you'd like on our website. The address is willag.org. I'm Todd Gleason. You have a good week.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Okay, you know the drill. The mics are still open, and it's all recording. Jackie has a question for you.
No,
as well.
I just wondered if you were still there, Mike. That's
yeah,
all.
I'm still here.
Oh, gosh. I'll tell you, it's going to be an interesting year, don't you think?
Yeah, and, you know, it kind of goes back to this report that Scott did and the politicalization of everything. And you know, protectionism and the politics, that's what always worries me when we get to price levels like this.
That and the actual European versus Chinese financial situations bother the heck out of me.
Yeah. Mike, right?
Right.
Yeah. I've been thinking, well, I think that your point is so well taken because the, you know, what happened when 08 with the rice export bans
and
what Russia has done has indicated that, you know, governments will react in these kind of perceived, whether it's really real or not, food crises in rather dramatic and potentially harmful ways much more quickly than I think most people in the marketplace and a lot of economists appreciate.
Well, I think that's where I'm fearful that the money managers turn from net longs to net shorts by the time the FAO gets done with everything in the next few months and all the stuff that they're probably going to be coming out as well with in terms of scaring everybody into not consuming anything. And that's when I go back to 08 and 96, that was where we really did see some merchandise export, you know, trade volume declines, and it was mainly due to the governments.
Right. Yeah, so it's your fear is not that they've become not that they're selling. Your fear is that they get out completely.
My fear is the money managers who are the high frequency guys, the quantitative guys. They can either be net long or net short. They're not the index guys who are only net long or out. My fear is that they turn in net shorts by the middle of the year because they see the higher interest rates, they see the inflation, and they see the governments, you know, kind of piling on with the food scare, and that they end up causing another type of 08 type break in the commodity markets. And I agree with everything that Jackie and Pete said as far as the stocks to use ratio. The devil's in the detail of what is the usage going to be in 2011.
So the lack of liquidity or the available liquidity pushes the market down.
Yeah.
I got a question. When you're talking about interest rates going up, do you think we're going to have higher interest rates until the housing mess is at least partly not here anymore? I mean, the housing mess is going to be worse this year and next year than it was last year.
Pete, I actually do, because I feel as though that the emerging markets are not going to keep buying our debt as much, and they're going to fight back on our Fed policy. And once they start to, it's just like Japan retook China this last month in terms of buying our treasuries. And I know that's only 1 month of data, but if you start to see a trend where China stops taking as much of our debt on, I think that naturally pushes interest rates back into the higher category when it comes to our country back here, regardless of the joblessness, regardless of the unemployment levels and the consumption levels. It essentially, to me, since they kept our interest rates low and they were on board with our monetary policy this last year and a half, if they jump ship and get off board with us, then I do think those interest rates start to work against us.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I think one of the spins on that, Mike, though, that I see is we've seen them come in and be pretty active buyers of the dollar. And you know, they're doing that, I believe, because of the fact that they want to protect their export business.
Right, I agree.
You know, the lower the dollar goes, the poorer their export business is. And so they're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place in terms of what to do and how to handle it. And so I think we are seeing interest rates and some inflation in pockets in the U.S., depending upon where things are starting to pick up. But I don't know, Pete, are you referring more to massive interest rate changes?
I'm talking massive interest rate change. I don't mean a percent, but the housing industry is in such bad shape with so many bad loans that are upside down. If they raise interest rates very much on those people, without housing being corrected some, our economy is going to be not getting any better.
Yeah, and I think to Jackie's point about China, you know, I've thought about this. In this last meeting they had here just this past week with that big state dinner and everything, and I think in 2011, probably the Chinese are going to want to appreciate their currency just so they can stimulate their consumption and get the United States and other countries off their backs. So if they do decide to allow their currency to appreciate, that would mean they'd buy less of our dollars. And so I think that all kind of dominoes effects, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they won't let their currency appreciate, but if they do, I guess it goes back to the last 2 years we've had the dollar on our side as far as commodity buying, and I just see some chinks in the armor here that would say maybe we don't have such an easy street situation coming into 2011. So.
Did you see it being ironic that Michelle Obama was doing this food thing?
Yeah, and then they had
less calories, and they had a 2,400 calorie dinner at the White House. I thought that was ironic.
I wish I would have been there with that kind of menu.
You know, I agree with you, Mike. I do think that it's possible that they may allow their currency to be, you know, to float some, which still makes us more competitive than they are, far as, and it makes our products more available to them, and certainly more desirable for them because they're cheaper. But when you talk about the government, I thought it was interesting today to see the EPA okay the 15% for now 50% of all the vehicles in the United States.
Yeah, I didn't even get around to asking that question.
Yeah, and, I was going to bring that
and
up.
And, you know, on Saturday, I had the opportunity to ask somebody from Washington, basically, is it likely that the EPA could come in and actually lower the mandate for ethanol? You know, Brazil did. Brazil dropped it 25%.
Right.
You know, down to 75% when sugar prices got too high. My impression always was that there was a threshold. You know, there was a futures price, perhaps, or something like that. But absolutely not.
There is
not. No, it's a set mandate.
The thing that was interesting was that, someone does have to petition them to do it. And at the same time, in 2008, he said they were within 1 week of reducing the mandate before we broke.
Is that right, Jackie?
Yes.
1 week?
That's what he said.
Wow. He also said they haven't even talked about it yet this year.
The other point, and I don't, 1 week, you'd have to have somebody petition, and you'd have to have a whole lot of things happening.
No, Texas did petition.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, and on behalf of Pilgrim's Pride.
And they had been working on it for 2.5 months. Before they got there.
But they decided well in advance of the market peak not to do that. I don't think it had anything to do with price levels.
But the thing that can be moved around, remember, is that we've still got, 400 million bushels worth of RINs that
but the point is my interpretation is that there's some debate on this, their ability, but I think that they actually have the ability to write down the mandate without going through the formal petition process.
Okay.
Because, see, they did that on cellulosic this year.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They just announced we don't have the production, but they have to have a justification. So the legalities of that are interesting. But so what? My question is, so what? We're already so far beyond the mandate. It's clear that the energy industry.
Money no matter what.
Yeah.
Well,
they're not. You'd eliminate it, and today they would still use it because it's in the economic interest of the blenders. They're making lots of money blending ethanol, so they're not going to stop.
The only people I see that would be truly hurt, and it could lead to a consolidation again in the ethanol, are the very small blend, the small ethanol plants, the guys who can't afford to run at 80%, let's say, versus running at 100%.
But the point is, they would still be running at 100%. Nobody's going to slow down. The mandate is irrelevant today.
Yeah.
That's what I...
The only impact they could have that I see, and I don't know if they can do this, is they could come in and say, we're gonna pull the mandate back to 80%. And we're only going to pay on 80% of the gallons.
I guess I still have a question about ethanol usage.
Well, they can't do that as a matter of the mandate is purely a quantity law. That's it. And there's this huge renewable fuel standard apparatus that's been set up to monitor that. The VTEC is separate, and they're even have a separate legislative authority. The VTEC is formally a part of the Internal Revenue Code. It's in the Internal Revenue Code because it's a tax credit. Sure. It has to be.
Sure.
And over the years, it has been attached to various bills and riders to get it done. This year, it was the tax compromise.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So
right.
That was kind of easy. And previously, it had been attached to the farm bill.
Yeah.
But it's not it, – that. That's why that – whatever that – writer is, it always has to originate in the finance committees.
Okay.
Because it is a tax issue. You will now have to go in and change the Internal Revenue Code again by an act of Congress and have the president sign it to change VTEC.
Okay.
It's not going to happen in 2011.
So I agree, basically, based on that, with everything that you say, I can tell you that with us working in the trade, if they came out and said they were going to reduce the mandate by 20%, it would take a million, bring a billion bushels of corn only statistically back onto the balance sheet, and you could see the trade take this and drop the bottom out of corn price down 50 cents or
but
more.
Why would it have any impact?
It's a trading issue.
I think she means it's a perception that
it's
it
a perception
would.
Issue. That's all it is.
But we're still going to use the same amount for ethanol.
Right.
My problem with the EPA is they've been using 40 to 60% ethanol in vehicles made by the U.S. since World War II. Why do we have to do all this research to see if we can use 10% or 15%?
Well, I think the interesting point on ethanol is that you can roughly imply out of our production and blending statistics that in parts of the country, I bet if you went down here on Lincoln Avenue and you had the appropriate testing equipment and went up and down these gas stations, there's a bunch of E11 and E12 in our cars.
Oh, yeah.
And when I run by
I
a station,
you.
Who tests?
That's right.
I've
and when I drive by
around.
A station that says we do not put ethanol in our gas, I don't stop there. And there's still stations that have that.
So we've been anticipating the expansion of the blend wall. I think the energy company because they make so much money. Blending ethanol, that's what people miss.
It's fantastic. I mean, when you look at what they make on a gallon of gasoline, and they work on such a small margin, they work on volume.
Well,
and
the quality, the quality of the crude, they could practically blend sludge with the ethanol.
Right.
Well,
that's
what they have to go to.
Well, the estimates are, ethanol right now is approaching 10%. So if you remove that, now there's potential. It would create huge problems in the short run because we no longer have the ability to replace the additive part, the MTBEs that ethanol replaced.
Right.
But so that would create a real problem. But you could go back to other ethanol blends from other kinds of products, and pretty quickly we could actually adjust.
What kind of stuff instead of ethanol?
Well, the most interesting thing, Daryl Good and I have tried to spend a lot of time the last couple of years understanding the gasoline market a lot more. And basically what we all see at the pump as, you know, generic gasoline is actually a very complex cocktail of various kinds of liquid fuels and additives. And the mix varies by season and different kinds of environmental standards and just the way you need to make gasoline when it's cold versus when it's warm. And so the best way I've understood it, just like we know a dairy producer or a hog producer or a cattle producer or anybody that's a livestock producer, whether they do this formally or some consultant helps them, they're all doing least cost feed rations.
Right.
You know, because you can meet the basic feed
needs
from various, you know, and there's of course limits on how you can combine these things,
right.
But within those limits, you will try to find the combo that minimizes.
That will produce more gallons of gas out of crude oil.
Well, and so they do the same thing in the energy industry. They will, depending on market conditions and the kind of refinery that they have, they will run different kinds of streams out of those refineries depending on relative prices. My basic understanding is that they really were caught flat-footed with the sudden rise of ethanol and the mandates, and they've really had to make substantial changes in the kinds of runs they have in their refineries because they were basically getting oxygenate from other sources of different kinds that, you know, there's naphtha.
Oh,
there's
they couldn't
benzenes,
figure out. They had, it took them too
toluenes.
Long to figure out the mix because of the oxygen.
There's
because,
all of these
because
different.
Because it's an
Yeah.
And so they've basically discovered that they were giving away oxygenate. In other words, you went up, you know, 87 gas was really
89
or 88.5.
Yeah.
And now they have. Not. Now they've figured out how to reoptimize. And my understanding is it's allowed them to use some lower oxygenate, low-value products more effectively now that they have ethanol. Basically, mm-hmm. It's understanding that naphtha, which is kind of a leftover low-value refinery output can now be combined with ethanol, and you still have high enough
oxygen. It was almost a waste product.
So they have they've and then when combined with whatever part of the VTEC that they get to keep, I mean, ethanol is still less than the price of gasoline right now, and they're able to sell ethanol regardless of its energy or any of these other things. It's all sold as 1 gallon of gasoline at the retail price. And so they're making money without the VTEC right now.
That's what
and
I mean.
Then you add the VTEC on, really, and that's just on top of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, so I got to run, guys.
All right. Hey, thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott.
All right.
Thank
bye-bye.
You.